This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Last year was a busy one for the General Assembly. They found themselves in special session a number of times, usually discussing things with direct impact on Charlotte, most notably HB 2. Their last special session came just before the end of the year, with the purpose of repealing that controversial law, which has cost the city and the state millions of dollars. Charlotte promised to repeal its non-discrimination ordinance, which had led to HB 2, if the legislature promised to repeal the law. That agreement seemed to be in place, so Charlotte followed through and repealed its ordinance, but the deal fell apart, leaving HB 2 in place and dramatically emphasizing a schism between the capital city and the Queen City. It would not be an exaggeration to call it a chasm of distrust. So that is why what we're going to spend the hour of this hour talking about, the Charlotte-Raleigh divide, how it came about, how that gap can be bridged, and also what's next for HB 2. Let's start that conversation with our go-to politics expert, Dr. Michael Bitzer, professor of political science at and provost of Catawba College in Salisbury. Welcome back.
Good to be here.
Nice to have you here. How would you describe the relationship between our city and the legislature?
Well, you know, we've always talked about the great state of Mecklenburg, and that is usually used in a disdain mode or tone.
Only there.
throughout the rest of the state, I would say. But this has really been something that I've studied state politics, and yes, there are other states that have this kind of schism between major urban areas, Atlanta and the rest of Georgia, Chicago and the rest of Illinois, New York and the rest of New York. But this has really become – I was watching the end of this last special session, and it just seemed like for some senators – The amount of anger and, as you said, disdain towards Charlotte is so palpable. And considering that this is one of the major economic drivers of the state, that population is being driven a lot by Mecklenburg and Wake County, you know, is this a danger of fracturing the state's politics to a point where it can't be repaired? I don't know,
but isn't this
and I hope not.
Isn't this a microcosm of what's happening all over the country?
Between urban areas and particularly rural areas, yes. It is a major chasm. 2016's election only made the division worse in terms of how urban areas voted versus how the rest of the state voted. And from what I've done in terms of the research is very much urban versus everybody else, suburban and rural.
There's an op-ed piece today in the New York Times, and it's titled, Why Rural America Voted for Donald Trump. Okay. And it's out of Knoxville, Iowa, and the writer writes, one recent morning I sat near two young men at a coffee shop here whom I've known since they were little boys. Now about 18, they pushed away from the table and one said, let's go to work, let the liberals sleep in. And the other nodded. And that was illustrative, he said, of the fact that these people have a different ethos than people in the urban areas. They are surrounded by family, by church, by hard work, by that work ethic that if you work hard, you're a good person,
yep,
et cetera. And they support the military, they support police, et cetera. And they think liberals are just lazy, out to lunch, out of touch.
Elitists.
Yeah. That's what this is about in many ways.
I'm becoming more and more convinced of that, that if you – we are in the heart of Uptown Charlotte. Mm-hmm. If you drive 45 minutes to an hour anywhere out of this region, you will come into a very different – take Rowan County. It is very much – even Rowan County has become polarized between the city of Salisbury and the rest of the county, and it is deep. There is deep mistrust between folks who live in dense urban areas and those folks outside in rural North Carolina and America.
And we're going to talk more about that as we go through this hour. But what is your take on what happened at the end of last year, particularly in the special session that was called specifically we all thought, at least, to repeal HB 2. Was Charlotte tricked into repealing its ordinance with the false promise? In other words, were we double-crossed, or did the legislature have a legitimate beef with what appeared to be a double-cross or trickery on our side of the equation?
I would defer to the two guests that are going to be on in a minute. My perception in just watching things unfold, when the surprise city council meeting on Monday morning happened, and in particular the condition that was put on the repeal by December 31st, I don't think that sent a promising signal, particularly to rural Republicans in the House, from what I understand. And then that just kind of set a negative tone of, well, if they're going to do that, we're going to do this. Mm-hmm. And it just it felt like, from an outsider's point of view, things just fell apart from the get-go. And that's I don't know any other inside information other than that.
Michael Bitzer is going to stick around with us now as we go into the second part of all this conversation. He's going to act as a nonpartisan gap filler for the remainder of the hour. We're going to ask two of the players in Raleigh to join us now. Senator Jeff Jackson is a two-term Democrat, and Senator Jeff Tart is a three-term, if I got this right, a Republican. Both represent Mecklenburg County, and thank you both for being here. And I must say that before we started, the conversation was completely civil.
Well, we'll change that.
What happened? Let's start there with the question I just asked Michael Bitzer. What happened from your point of view? Was the legislature double-crossed, or was the city council double-crossed? What happened? Jeff Jackson, you want to start?
Sure. He's pointing at me, so let me start. here's what I think happened. I'm not in the Republican caucus. They spent a lot of time meeting behind closed door on that day, so I can't report exactly what the rationale was. But my basic theory here is that Speaker Moore and Senator Berger said they had the votes to Roy Cooper, and they really didn't have the votes. And I don't think they knew they didn't have the votes. I don't think they were misleading in saying to Roy Cooper, we can deliver this. I think they actually thought they could. And when they got there, it turned out there was much more resistance than they anticipated. I don't know if they did a thorough job in actually counting the votes before they agreed to the deal. So Senator, when they showed up, they lost half their caucus.
Senator Chart.
Yeah, I guess my first comment will be, what we need to really avoid right now is playing the blame game. Who and all, and that's all of us in going forward. So to get that off the table, I personally, individually, am completely responsible for all the problems with HB2 for the state. Now that's behind us. You can all blame me, and now we'll move forward looking for a solution.
So you're Dan Bishop?
No, Dan's not actually totally responsible for where we are now. But here's the point that's important. I think this is a breakdown of communications. And it's a breakdown in the relationships. It's like whether it's at church, whether it's at Scouts, whether it's at home with your family, business. And so what has happened, I think Jeff's exactly right. You don't call a special session. You don't have 170 members go to Raleigh without knowing you've done counts. We got called the day before and 2 days before that, reaffirming, are we going to be willing to repeal HB2?
Yeah.
Now, what happens in the span of time is different things and dynamics are going on with Charlotte City Council, what's going on with us and our caucus, few of the issues change. And that's why we were in 3 days. That's why in the last day we were actually 10 hours, while basically, because it's the process was going through the Senate, and the House is purely just waiting on us. And what you're trying to do is, as the dynamics shift, it's really Dan Blue and Phil Berger that have to agree what we're going to pass as legislation. And that was the dynamic, just the going back and forth.
You talked about a breakdown of personal relationships. Mm-hmm. And the city council here in Charlotte announced yesterday, I think it was, that they would be moving their annual retreat from Charlotte to Raleigh so that they could then go and meet with individual members of the legislature while you are in session. I'm not sure exactly when that takes place. I think sometime in this month or early next month. Will that help? Will city council coming to seek you out be helpful?
Well, it can't hurt, but here's the thing. We have something called Town Hall Day. All the municipalities and counties come and visit the legislature when we're in session. What needs to happen, it needs to be ongoing dialogue, not just a single day. You have to develop personal relationships. Somebody like Jeff and I that can sit down and talk through issues and break bread together.
How big is the Mecklenburg County delegation within the House and Senate?
17 members. Mm-hmm.
And what is the percentage of that with regard to the rest of the legislature?
10%. And so 10%. Between Wake and Raleigh, you have 20% of all the votes in two counties out of 100.
So most of the legislature is rural?
And all the leadership right now.
For the majority part.
Is that the problem?
Well, when you have supermajority, basically veto override capability in the study of legislatures, yes, we are a legislative supremacy state, meaning that typically the governors tend to be weaker than, say, the president. And when you have the numbers to be able to override a gubernatorial veto, from a political scientist point of view, whoever's in the majority party can do whatever they want.
Yeah. Let me get an answer from both of the senators on this. There seems to have always been, I've lived here a long time, and there seems to have always been this tension between the city of Charlotte and Mecklenburg County to a great degree and the legislature in Raleigh. They do view us as the great state of Mecklenburg, and they kind of spit those words out because it's extremely distasteful to them. And it's been amplified in recent years by things like the legislature's attempt to take control of the Charlotte airport, passing of legislation that has allowed for toll roads, as you well know, Senator Tarte, up toward your part of the county, and now the passage of HB2 because of a Charlotte ordinance and the failure to repeal it on the part of the legislature. It just looks like we have broken promises and power grabs going on from Raleigh toward Charlotte all the time. What is the crux of the problem?
Well, if I had the answer, then we probably wouldn't be sitting here. I'd either be writing a book or I'd have gone and solved it. But you see things like you mentioned the airport, part of its perception. There was the city council had hired an independent consultant that interviewed multiple people, and their answer from the independent consultant the council had hired said make it an authority. The authority was approved and put forward by Walter Dalton, a Democratic lieutenant governor. It was a Republican legislature that acted on it. So we have those things as, you know, do we really understand the message? But I tell you, living the last 25 years, 15 miles north of uptown in Cornelius, when I'm locally, I tell people I'm from Cornelius, not Charlotte. Yet when I travel, I always tell people I'm from Charlotte. People know where it is. It's a world-class city. We've got to get past this.
Yeah. Senator Jackson, let me get your perspective
on that. The crux of the problem is gerrymandering and the fact that the only people who really set the legislative agenda for this state or who control elections are the 10% of the state who votes in a Republican primary. The split is 35-15 in the state Senate right now, 35 Republicans, 15 Democrats. That's in a state that's roughly 50-50. The reason the split is 35-15 is because Republicans drew all the districts in a way to try and maximize how many Republicans they could fit into the state legislature. My party doesn't have clean hands on gerrymandering. We engaged in partisan gerrymandering for a long time. I will also add, we never tried to test the theoretical limits of gerrymandering, but we certainly took the low road on that issue for a long time. Now we're in a situation where we have a very small number of people who basically are invulnerable in a general election. 90% of us actually are invulnerable in a general election, but the leadership is absolutely invulnerable. And so they can take shots at Charlotte, and it is to their political benefit, or so they feel, because that plays well with the 10% of North Carolina that votes in their primary. But the other 90% of us are waiting for someone to talk to us. 90% of the state has been pushed out of the political equation by design.
Okay. And Senator Jeff Jackson, we're coming back with more on this. I'm going to follow up on gerrymandering in a second. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Ruth's Chris Steakhouse, featuring a steak and wine menu for business meetings, private parties, or dinner. Uptown location open for lunch and dinner, South Park for dinner. More info at ruthschris.com. And Center for Compliance and Ethics, offering an online corporate compliance certificate program for lawyers and non-lawyers, hosting a webinar for prospective students on January 9th. Registration at charlottecompliancecenter.com. on a special edition of our local news roundup. Tomorrow, On Point's Tom Ashbrook will join us to talk about the thrust of his show, which came into our consciousness by moving from just 7 o'clock at night to 10 o'clock in the morning. We'll talk to him, and then he will join our regular roundtable of reporters to talk about, give us a national perspective on some of the things that have been affecting North Carolina. Roy Cooper becoming the state's next governor, his cabinet choices, whether or not they'll get Senate approval, Dylan Roof representing himself in the sentencing phase of his trial in Charleston, and more, and that's tomorrow at 9.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Ford nixes a Mexico plant and promises 700 U.S. jobs. Can Trump's arm twisting bring manufacturing jobs back home in a big way? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Join On Point with Tom Ashbrook from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the great divide between Charlotte and Raleigh with two state senators, Senator Jeff Tarte, Republican from Mecklenburg County, Senator Jeff Jackson, a Democrat from Mecklenburg County, and Dr. Michael Bitzer, who is a professor of political science at Catawba College. Senator Jackson just mentioned that the problem in his eyes is gerrymandering. There's going to be a redrawing of districts, we think, because of a court order going forward. Will that solve the – do you think that's the problem, and will that solve the problem, Dr. Bitzer?
I think it is certainly part of it. I would also contend that the electorate and the populace has become more sorted, making it easier for map drawers to be able to create these heavily partisan districts. And what I mean by that is that more and more precincts are showing non-competitiveness in elections, meaning that one party is kind of situated in one area and the other party is situated in another area. And the dynamics of the way people are voting and behaving politically means that we are sorting ourselves into like-minded communities. We are pockets of partisanship in various areas. And for map drawers, it is very easy to isolate individuals, put them into districts that only reconfirm what they feel and what they believe in politically, and that creates the tension that I think we're seeing in terms of polarization. Polarization is here. Yeah. It is very evident. And, you know, part of it is our own fault for not being willing to, for lack of a better term, compromise and to see the value and benefit of the other side.
Senator Jackson also mentioned that the Democratic Party is not – they don't have clean hands on this issue either. But they didn't – he alluded to the fact that they didn't push it to the limits that he views the Republicans having done so. So when you combine the kind of gerrymandering we've witnessed under Republican control, mm-hmm. along with the limiting of the governor's power, the new governor's power by the Republican-controlled legislature, mm-hmm. removing powers, extra powers that they gave to the previous governor who was a Republican – are the Republicans overshooting the mark?
From a neutral partisan perspective, I'm more of an institutionalist, meaning that the branches of government can do what they want to do within the bounds of certain separation of powers notions. And what the legislature giveth, the legislature can taketh away. And I think with granting more appointment powers to Governor McCrory, but then taking them away from now Governor Cooper, that's just part of the game of politics, that a legislature can do that. When it comes to the partisanship, it is very much being driven more and more by a more conservative Republican Party. I think if you look at somebody like Senator Tarte and compare it to a Republican from a rural county, I think that there are very clear differences in terms of philosophical and ideological beliefs that rural Republicans are indeed the kind of driving force within the Republican conference.
Do you see a connection between what happened with HB2, first of all, the passage of it in response to the Charlotte ordinance, and then the lack of repeal in response to the fact that Charlotte did a double repeal, essentially, on that night, the night before they went to a vote in Raleigh? Do you see a connection between those things and the attempt to take control of the airport and other things that have happened between Raleigh and Charlotte? Is it all part of a story that's playing out?
Well, I think we tend to focus a lot on Charlotte, but there have been other attempts. I think people would point to things like the Asheville water system, things like Greensboro redistricting, things like Raleigh redistricting.
The water system in Asheville?
That was the takeaway as well. I think that there is that divide, and it's urbanism versus everybody else in this state.
Which puts the two of you gentlemen in an interesting situation, because you're in Raleigh as state senators, but you're also representing the cash cow of the state, the urban engine of the state, one of them, and certainly the biggest. How does that impact the two of you?
Well, and it's a requirement that members in the local delegation are communicating and working together. And you know, first thing everybody's got to understand, we deal with maybe 1,200 pieces of legislation in this session. We probably pass 300 or 400 of those. But you have to realize 85% to 90% of that legislation passes almost with unanimous bipartisan support. People, that doesn't get mentioned. It's the handful of things like HB2, the airport, social issues tend to be divided on ideological lines.
Senator Jackson?
Well, he's right about that. But as someone who represents the city of Charlotte going into this legislative session, it's important to be realistic about what we stand to accomplish as far as a legislative agenda that could benefit Charlotte. I think we're going in there with a mentality of do no harm. We're working on sales tax redistribution. We expect that to come up. That's something that could really hit Charlotte. The bottom line there would be, if a lot of our sales tax money ends up being redistributed to rural parts of the state, it will almost certainly require a significant rise in our property tax, somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 to 15%. So we are watching that issue. It was barely beaten back last year, and we expect it to come back this year. If we just survive this session and get HB2 repealed, that's a huge win for Charlotte.
Well, outgoing State Senator Bob – go ahead, Senator Trump.
Mike, I was just going to add one thing that – you know, and Dr. Bitzer will appreciate this perhaps, but what we see getting accentuated more and more is what I call retribution politics, that if you vote against something or you're not supportive of this, you'll pay, if you will, or there'll be some retribution until you get in a line with the direction. And politely, that needs to stop.
Well, Senator Bob Rucho, outgoing State Senator Bob Rucho, a Charlotte Republican, says he's worried that ill will over HB2 will spill over into other legislation. And we have transportation issues in Charlotte that we're concerned about, projects that need state funding. We have always felt shortchanged in highway funds in this part of the world. There's this strategic transportation investment formula that I believe Governor McCrory kind of strong-armed the legislature into agreeing to, that is at risk now, which changed the way highway funds are distributed. City also wants to make sure that sales tax revenues are distributed fairly, because of what Senator Jackson just said. Might this happen as retribution for bad behavior, a slap on the wrist?
Anything's possible, and sure, we've seen it over the years. It's happened from both sides of the aisle.
Is that wise to hurt the economic engine of the state?
Of course not.
But it would happen anyway because of
– maybe. I don't know.
Is it the third grade?
Not to the extent that, you know, you're punishing people. That doesn't happen. But let's get back to, in a sense –
But that would happen. That's exactly what it is.
Maybe. Maybe not. It depends on what the issue is and what you're doing and who it's directed towards.
Well, I mean, if they redistribute highway funds in a way that Charlotte doesn't get its fair share, if they redistribute sales taxes in a way that we have to raise property taxes substantially in Mecklenburg County – that's not fair.
Yes, that would not be, but there are mechanisms in place like transportation dollars. There's now something called the STI model, which prevents that because it's data-driven. It doesn't allow politics to enter in like it used to be. So there's things that we're implementing that address that. But one thing before we get too far away in the show is kind of addressing what's referred to as the dead moose on the table. And that being is, how do we address HB2? How do we fix it? What's the answer going forward? And that's an important thing that we have a conversation around.
Well, the first thing I think that has to be agreed upon is whether there's been any negative economic impact in HB2, because you have Governor McCrory, who spent a great deal of time saying, no big deal. Phil Berger, same thing, no big deal. Whereas millions of dollars have, on the face of it, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure this out. When the NBA pulls their All-Star weekend, and when the ACC and the NCAA pulls their games, and companies refuse to locate in North Carolina or change their plans, surely that doesn't take a rocket scientist to know that we're losing millions of dollars.
You'd have to live under a rock.
So don't we have to admit that first, that this has been economically hurtful?
Well, when I met with Mayor Roberts probably 4 days after the Charlotte Ordinance was passed, and we met privately, and one comment, she said, you know, this is going to cost us millions of dollars. And I said, no, it won't. This is going to cost us maybe hundreds of millions of dollars. This is going to have a massive economic impact.
Is this talked about in the Republican caucus?
Yes, but also you have to understand and balance that. Statewide, 8 weeks ago, we were ranked the second best state for business by Forbes magazine. So would we have been number one without HB2? Maybe. But it has an impact. You can't ignore that. 70% of the population now believes that HB2 hurts the state.
What about the impact of our image? Does that matter at all?
Of course. It's perception.
Does it really?
Perception becomes somebody else's reality.
And with the amount of national news that has been directed on North Carolina, that has to have some impact.
But if you're voting on social issues because you really believe that what Charlotte did was wrong and unnecessary, and as the governor, the former governor said, an issue, a problem in search of a solution. What did he say?
A solution in
search of a problem. Yeah. If you really truly believe that, do you care that people outside the state think that we're a bunch of yahoos?
Yes, of course you do, because it impacts growth and business and people.
But you'd have to compromise your personal beliefs to satisfy the rest of the nation. Would you do that? Why would you do that?
Now, I'll recognize things like RFRA, which impact this. There are 19 states. We look at the anti-discrimination rules and laws that are on the books in North Carolina, same ones that are in 28 other states. So there's a balance as we look at that going forward. But I think the core issues, two core issues, and that we need to put on the table, one is going to be involve HB2. One is around grant of authority, deals with Dillon Rule. That is really the central theme, the yin and yang between Raleigh and the municipalities and the counties. And then secondarily, we're going to have to deal with the LGBT and protected class. That's the heart and soul.
I know that we're a Dillon Rule state, and that's something probably most people never heard of before HB2 came up. But we certainly talked about it a lot on this program. Michael Bitzer, tell us why we're a Dillon Rule state. Where did that come from?
Dillon was a judge in Indiana who basically laid out a back in the 1800s.
Okay. 1868, John Dillon was Supreme Court Justice, actually of Iowa.
Okay.
And that's where it came from.
Okay.
And it basically says that control of local governments can be driven by the state. And so what the state creates, the state can destroy, the state can modify. This is different from a state like South Carolina that is more of a home rule in that the legislature says, municipalities, local governments, you can do what you want unless we take that power away from you.
And that's enshrined in the North Carolina Constitution?
It is. What we are is referred to as a modified Dillon Rule. There's 23 items that we have no authority to do. As an example, we can't change the name of a town. However, within our ability of the legislature is to take your charter away to eliminate you. But there's things like we can't regulate cemeteries, we can't grant divorces. It's very specific things.
I hate to leave you out of the conversation here, Jeff Jackson, but as a Republican, Jeff Tart, Senator Tart, Republicans love to point to power grabs in Washington and activist judges in Washington, and they hate it when the federal government tells them that they have to do something. Why is that? Why isn't what's good for the goose good for the gander? Why is it okay then for you to come in as a legislature and tell Charlotte what its elected representatives can and cannot do? What's the difference?
Well, I was mayor for three terms in Cornelia, so I get the differential between what's the authority of the legislature. Usually what the legislature should be looking at are things that require uniformity of application across the entire state. Let's use minimum wage. What you want to be careful of is, do you allow individual towns to set that, which is one of the things we address in HB 2. And where, like, I have Matthews and Mint Hill in my district, if you have bakers across the street, do you disadvantage one by forcing their labor costs to be higher? You have to be careful. It would be, the analogy would be, would you allow every town to set and determine whether they're going to implement daylight savings time? Do you want to go in and be off an hour every place between counties? Mm-hmm. So that's the place I use as a litmus test.
What's your view on that, Senator Jackson?
Well, I want to give Senator Tarr some credit here. One of the things that he talks about a lot is the importance of having a sound process for working through legislation. He really does believe, contrary to a lot of folks up there who are in charge right now, that you need to have all stakeholders at a table. You need to actually work through the existing committee structure because it exists for a reason. And none of that happened with the partisan power grab session that we had. So you've got content problems with respect to the bills in and of themselves and what they contained. But I think almost everyone can agree that the process was completely unacceptable.
When you were on your way to Raleigh, you're driving up to Raleigh for this special session, Senator Jackson, did you think you were going there to repeal HB 2, that it was going to happen?
I told people I thought it was 50-50.
Really?
I did.
Why?
And you know what? They reacted just the way you did right now. They said, you're giving them 50% that it's going to happen? And I said, I think that's important, because if this is truly a good faith gesture by the other side, by the Republican leadership, I want to meet that. I want to give them the benefit of the doubt and say, I am here for you if you are ready to bury the hatchet.
But it costs taxpayers money to call you guys into special session, and it's certainly inconvenient for you because this is not your full-time job. So why would Phil Berger call into a session, a special session, that he thought he didn't have enough votes to accomplish what he wanted to accomplish in the session?
Well, first statement is Phil Berger can't. That was done by the governor. Okay, but yeah, well, nobody would call
consultation with.
Nobody would go back. I would tell you, 99.9% sure we were repealing HB2. That's the only reason we were going there.
So that, you were more certain than the Democrats were.
I thought it was a done deal that we were going to repeal it.
So why didn't it go through? Was it simply that we had this situation where Charlotte very quickly and with no warning repealed their ordinance? Under the we think now it was because Roy Cooper had been talking with the legislature, and he had worked out a compromise. If you do this, they will do this. So they repealed the ordinance, and then late that next night, it was discovered by somebody at the legislature that they didn't repeal all of it. So Charlotte City Council comes back and repeals all of it, but the stink was in the air. Is that what happened?
It's exactly what happened.
But why? They went ahead and did it all.
Well,
and they didn't have to do it all anyway,
well,
did they?
Here's the thing. We Monday and Tuesday, they're polling, basically calling to see, do we have the votes? Will you support repealing? We get there Wednesday morning, 9 o'clock. We're in caucus prior to going into session at 10. And they're saying, oh, by the way, it's actually not completely repealed. They're going to have an emergency session. Guess what? Charlotte's going to do a special session in about 2 hours.
Morning.
And repeal it. We got to get over the nuances and a little different. It got done. Let's move forward. But it changed. People were worried, and this is where the cooling off period came in.
Yes, the moratorium. Now, that's the other part of this that the Democrats could not buy into in Raleigh. At one point after the last special session, Senator Chart, you pointed to it, Durham City Councilman Charlie Reese.
One of the
Who had tweeted that the repeal of HB2 would mean cities will be able to take actions currently prohibited by HB2 to prevent discrimination, and promising that Durham would stand with our trans brothers and sisters and against discrimination and bigotry in all forms. In other words, they were going to pass an ordinance like Charlotte, and so a moratorium, a six-month moratorium was proposed, which would prevent cities from doing this for 6 months. Why were Democrats opposed to that?
Two big reasons. The first one was that wasn't the deal. We had a very clear deal. There weren't a lot of amendments to that deal. It was repeal for repeal, and the Charlotte City Council was only going to repeal its ordinance in exchange for an agreement to fully repeal. And contrary to a myth that has sprung up, the first time they got an offer from the leadership of the General Assembly to fully repeal HB2 was after the election. So they got that offer. They said, okay. Then they broke the deal. The other concern was, well, we can get to the other concern.
The other concern will be coming up after the break. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and CFA Society North Carolina, hosting their annual forecast dinner Tuesday, January 10th, providing education and support to North Carolina's investment professionals. Information and registration at cfanorthcarolina.org. And the Pump House Restaurant, featuring a Southern-inspired cuisine in a restored multi-level pump house with a rooftop bar located at the Riverwalk in Rock Hill. More info at rockhillpumphouse.com. This week, Ford Motor Company hit the brakes on a plant in Mexico and promised hundreds of U.S. jobs. Can Donald Trump's arm-twisting revive American manufacturing and bring jobs back home? That's one of the questions they'll be tackling on Point, coming up in 20 minutes to 10 o'clock with Tom Ashbrook. We're coming right back in a moment to talk about the great divide, the schism between Charlotte and Raleigh. Stay with us.
President-elect Donald Trump has begun to fill key positions in his administration.
Donald Trump's latest cabinet pick is a man who was once his rival for the presidency.
As he faces a divided nation.
The fact that he won is not okay. It just shows how closed-minded America is.
Whatever direction you think the country should take, you can turn to NPR for the facts to make sense of it all. Listen every day.
News you can trust from 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're sitting here in our Spirit Square studio where no blood has yet been spilled with Senator Jeff Jackson, a Democrat from Mecklenburg County, Senator Jeff Tartt, Republican from Mecklenburg County, and Dr. Michael Bitzer, Professor of Political Science at and Provost of Catawba College in Salisbury. And we're talking about the distrust, the great chasm between Charlotte and Raleigh, and also what happened, and as we go forward in this hour, what will happen next, what needs to happen next with regard to HB2. You have me hanging by my fingernails, Jeff Jackson. What was the second reason that the Democrats were upset about this moratorium?
Second reason we were deeply concerned about the moratorium was that we were worried it was going to be extended indefinitely, because they said it's going to continue through the long session and then another month. And we all know that's because they're going to try and work something out that will appease their base in the interim. We can't see exactly what that is. We think there's a good chance that we come to the end of our next legislative session and they say, tell you what, it's actually going to be the end of the next legislative session. And then we just have HB2 by another name. And that's unacceptable. It's unacceptable economically and unacceptable morally.
Now, the original ordinance that people had trouble with in Charlotte, they focused on the bathroom aspect, the transgender bathroom and the transgender locker room aspect of this. But HB2 not only knocked that out of the water, it took away all protections for LGBT people throughout the state, that in areas where they already existed, including Charlotte. I'm trying to find the question here, and I guess the question is why? That seems all another example of let's just take it all.
Sure.
Overreach.
Well, let me address that first of all. That's not true. Because
what's not true?
That we took away all protections.
There are no LGBT protections, as I understand them, on the books in North Carolina state law, correct?
There were none. There weren't even the federal. So we actually matched the federal law. There was none for race.
Charlotte, there were, and in, I believe, Wake County, there were ordinances to protect LGBT people.
Sure.
And your HB2 took them all away, wiped them off
the books.
Absolutely
not true. And here's why. I'll give you one example.
Okay.
Housing discrimination exists in the charters of the municipalities. You can't discriminate on a housing, on renting an apartment because somebody's gay. HB2 has no override over that. That's city ordinance. HB2 was only for public accommodations of public a government and public facility. That's it. That's the limit.
Agree with that, Senator Jackson? Is that true?
It was yes. I mean, technically, that legal point is accurate. However, it did repeal every single non-discrimination ordinance in the state, not just the LGBT ones, the mm-hmm. few that we had. It repealed all of the ones applying to race, all of the ones applying to gender, all of the ones
veterans,
applying to religion. Yeah. And it replaced it with a statewide non-discrimination policy, but that has no enforcement mechanism. So whereas if you had been a hotel owner in Charlotte and you had said, we don't serve African Americans here, the city could come in and shut you down by force of law. Now, after HB2, If you hang that sign up, you cannot be shut down by the state.
So people who are against HB 2 have said part of the reason that they're against it is because it codifies discrimination. Is that true?
In the sense that it said you cannot protect people against discrimination, yes.
And here's the bigger problem. There's a perception that does that. And like I said, perception becomes other people's reality. And as we've said, first of all, we can't open up bathrooms to everybody going everywhere. And we come back and address that. But the bathroom issue really isn't the big thing. It's about protected class. And we should never allow discrimination against anyone.
So Charlotte passed this ordinance, and in the shadow of the possibility that the legislature would repeal HB 2, Durham, at least one city council person in Durham, said they would pass a similar ordinance. To me, just as a bystander, that's an indication that there are urban areas in the state that see a value in this. And whether it's a value because we have to be open and inclusive to be competitive nationally, or whether you just have a moral issue with it, they see a value in this. So if Durham sees a value, if Wake County sees a value, if Mecklenburg County sees a value, why not let them do it? If Albemarle County doesn't want to do it, then they don't do it.
And that may end up being the ultimate way we address HB 2 is letting it be a referendum and let the people vote and determine.
And I just think the legacy for HB 2 is going to end up being massive civil rights progress for the LGBT community and for the transgender community in particular. You know, from my standpoint, HB 2 was never about bathrooms. It was always a political play. It was always a witch hunt designed to target a very vulnerable minority population, the transgender population. And now it's very clear you don't get to do that in the United States of America. The consequences, political and economic, are such that you are now barred from doing that. I guarantee you, if the Republicans could get in a time machine and go back to early March, they would not pick this fight because they lost it. Mm-hmm. And they're just trying to figure out how to wiggle out of it now.
In fact, is that part of the dragging of the feet here? And maybe I'll bring this to you, Michael, mm-hmm. but the fact that it would be politically better for a lot of people if the courts made this decision.
Oh, yeah. Let a third party deal with it. And that's
– The activist courts.
Well, yeah. I think ultimately this issue about protected class and where non-discrimination and equal protection of the law comes into will ultimately have to be decided by the courts. I think for Republicans, their base does not want this bill repealed. And I think, you know, the special interest groups on the right that were activated during that special session made it very clear, you know, do not do this. Or, as Senator Tarte talked about, the politics of retribution, it's not just within the caucuses and the conferences within the legislature. It's on the ground and the partisanship that drives the primary election to be the general election. If you violate a core principle of a political party, the voters who are activists, who are on the grassroots, that are energized, who show up in primary elections, will take you out.
I know we've talked about this before, but let's talk about it really briefly one more time. It didn't used to be this way, did it?
It didn't because the parties were less ideologically pure, meaning that the Republican Party had liberal Rockefeller Republicans and the Democratic Party had these conservative Southern Democrats, and now the parties have basically purified themselves. And that's who shows up.
So when you have this kind of polarization nationally and locally and at the state level, and when you have this complete distrust of one or the other, liberals versus conservatives, Democrats versus Republicans, urban versus rural, you can do many divides, but they're all
sure.
They all boil down to the same thing because the parties have taken the side of one faction or the other. When you have this going on, can you govern this country?
Not in the system that we have of separation of powers. And that's just the dynamic of this is going to be a whole new experiment for North Carolina because of a Democratic governor and a very supermajority Republican-controlled legislature. This year is going to be unlike anything I think we've seen in a very long time.
You disagree with that, Senator Tarte?
Not completely, but here's one thing going back to the point talking about letting the courts decide. And I said that like a year ago, that's where it would ultimately get. But, you know, that's taken the easy way out. We're all elected to make decisions, work collaboratively together across the aisle and stuff. And I think the conversation, this is why, as Senator Jackson mentioned earlier, I thought we would actually take this into the long session. We'd stop doing the goofy special sessions, being there for 24 hours, people not understanding, people getting a chance on the other side to look at the language of the bill, that we'd actually put it into the legislative process. Take 6 months. Let's work through committees. Let's have public comments. Let's have experts come and talk. Because on protected class, one really key issue that's got to be educated, I need to learn more, I think we all to understand, is the concept of benign and immutable characteristics. Because those are typically the foundation to determine that's a group that should be protected. Mm-hmm. When you get into sexual orientation and gender identity, they become hard to define, and that allows the individual actor to define whether I'm protected by the law or not. And those are issues we need to discuss.
How is it, Jeff Jackson, that we can have this discussion on the air? No blood has been spilled. No one has raised their voice yet. No one has accused the other of being the devil incarnate. How can we have this on the air? And we can't have it in Raleigh. And we can't have it between Charlotte and Raleigh and the legislature there. Why is this?
My theory is that the leadership has decided politically they can't be seen in the same room or same building with Charlotte City Council and seen collaborating with Democratic legislators.
Sounds like junior high school to me.
Well, it is, but you got to remember how these primaries work, right? If Phil Berger is seen in a photograph with Jennifer Roberts, he has a major problem from his right. And the primary is the only election that determines whether or not these guys get to go back to Raleigh. If they were in competitive general elections.
You're sitting in the same room together, on the same program together. Aren't you going to be accused of being a traitor to one side or the other?
We are, actually. And tell you something interesting. I tweeted during the HB2 failure to repeal session. I was tweeting about how that was going down, and I was not happy about it. But I decided to also tweet, you know what, there are good people on both sides, and you should remember that. And I have never received such vitriol in response to a tweet ever as that one. People telling me to resign in disgrace. And that was from a very bland comment of, hey, there are good people on both sides.
That is the thing that scares the living daylights out of me, is that mentality of it is my way or
no
forget
way.
About it.
Well, I will tell you this, and I say it publicly all the time. There's 170 members, 120 reps, 150 senators. And there's not a person I believe that's not trying to do what they think is good for the state of North Carolina and the citizens. I absolutely believe that in all my DNA. We just ideologically have a very different approach as how to solve the same problem.
Yeah. You, in your background, as I understand it, Senator Chart, were a mediator, essentially. I mean, not really. I mean, you are I'm trying to find my notes on this. You were with Ernst & Young, and as a manager there, had to find solutions to problems, and difficult problems in some cases. Is there a solution to this? I mean, Charlotte has done everything it can do. We have repealed the ordinance. We are out of the game. We have no more cards to play. So it's all up to you guys in Raleigh.
Yeah, part of it is going back and, you know, kind of we're beating the dead horse a little bit, but it needs to be an open process. All the stakeholders have to have a seat at the table. It's the only way you solve a problem. We need to be willing to listen first rather than come up with the answer before we understand the issues and the positions of others. We need to be pragmatic. We need to be thoughtful. The hardest thing right now is
how likely is that to happen?
It's possible. I mean, likely
it's
it has
possible.
To happen. We do it on issues, on certain ones. We need to expand it into the social arena, right? But people are so entrenched and so passionate about their beliefs. But you've got to be willing to be respectful of people of different opinions.
This great urban-rural divide, this big divide between the legislature and the great state of Mecklenburg, we see it. Jeff Jackson, does the legislature see it? Do you know that there are people in the legislature who feel that way or see it, recognize it, and think it's unfortunate?
They thrive on it. I mean, there are people there who seek to accentuate that through their rhetoric. I mean, you hear people on the floor of the Senate call people in Charlotte lunatics. That's a direct quote. And I don't think they actually believe that. That's for public consumption, what they think is good for them back home, again, in the folks who vote in a primary. So there is a rural-urban divide. It's a global trend. If you Google rural-urban divide, what comes up first isn't North Carolina. It's Kenya. It's Colorado. It's all over the place. And that's because of economics and technology. But there's a piece of this that is being artificially amplified for political gain. If we put that down, we could have a rational conversation about how to help everyone.
Why isn't there a great state of Wake County or a great state? What county is Durham in? Guilford?
Durham County.
Why aren't they in the same fix?
Probably because they're closer to the capital, and it's easier to throw stones at people who are a two-hour drive away.
But we have telephones. People text each other and tweet, et cetera.
Not so much in the General Assembly, Mike, but I hear your general point.
Okay, I'm gonna go the other end of the spectrum and say it's envy. It's envy because we are the greatest county in the state of North Carolina. We are the economic engine and driver with the university system in the state of North Carolina.
And if Phil Berger heard you say that, or if other people elsewhere in the state assembly heard you say that, would they just want to slap you silly?
I don't know. I'll find out next week.
I mean, do you say that around them?
I do.
Do they admit that we're the economic engine and that hurting the economic engine hurts everybody?
Sure. I mean, because these are educated people.
But rural areas are hurting just as much, if not more.
And they're looking for help.
And they're looking for the help.
And getting back to that op-ed piece that I referred to very early in the program this morning in the New York Times, one of the things that they talk about in Iowa, not North Carolina, is the fact that, yes, rural Iowans see that the cities are the engines, and they understand that the cities get all the good toys. They get the roads. They get the transportation systems. They get the infrastructure because they need it. But then they feel jealous because they didn't get it, and their small towns are dying.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have three counties out of the 100 that have a higher death rate than birth rate. Put that in perspective. I mean, there's counties that are really hurting, and we have to figure out how do we help. We're an entire state.
So given that reality, why are we wasting all of this time on something that the elected representatives of Charlotte, who could be voted out of office if the people in Charlotte didn't like what they did with the ordinance, why are we wasting all this time with it?
Because a small number of Republicans think it's to their political gain, and this HB2 issue backfired in a way they never anticipated.
Okay.
And there you have it.
Kyle on Twitter said, could this be solved by giving more power to cities and counties? Is there any way to make us not a Dillon state?
Go home.
Well, I don't think that's possible, candidly. You're not going to let go because there's things that do need to be uniform laws applied. What we probably need to think about doing is a process that codifies the rules of Dillon. And what are the things that are in municipal control? What aren't?
Do you see the legislature getting rid of HB2 in this next session?
Yeah, I'm gonna be optimistic and say yes, that there's a renewed round of economic pressure.
You get the last word. Senator Jeff Jackson, Democrat. Senator Jeff Tarte, Republican. Dr. Michael Bitzer, Catawba College. Thank you.